Hello, and thank you for downloading this Conversations podcast. If you don't already subscribe, you can do it completely free of charge. It's easy. Details are on our website, abc.net.au/conversations, or just look for Conversations with Richard Feidler through iTunes.
Welcome to Conversations. My name's Trent Dalton, and I'm sitting in for Richard Feidler. My guest today played one of the world's first television lesbians. Of all the inmates of Cell Block H in that classic Australian TV show Prisoner, there were none more vicious and none more bonkers than lesbian bikey Frankie Doyle. It was one of television's most daring and nasty roles, played by one of Australia's most graceful and elegant actors, Carol Burns. She's worked on the West End and traded lines with Jack Thompson and Geoffrey Rush. She's worked on stage and screen for 45 years, but some of her most important work has been done offstage, fighting for the rights of working actors and establishing a group that helps ageing actors through life when the money stops coming in. Carol Burns, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for the invitation, Trent. It's lovely to talk to you.
Carol, can you remind me of the wonderful term that Frankie Doyle had for her prison warden?
She had a loving term for her, vinegar tits, which has gone down through the generations, because that show was done in, I left it in 1979 after having done 19 episodes. But they were the most memorable 19 episodes because they kept on referring back to them over the next 6 months, and they'd say, it wasn't like that when Frankie Doyle was here, and they would have one of those old-fashioned flashbacks and talk about Frankie Doyle's story. But all of us came to Prisoner from theatre, which was a remarkable thing in those days. The producers, I think, were very brave because they just put the casting net wide, and it didn't depend whether you were in Sydney or Melbourne, because a lot of casting these days has become very centric to those two cities. Whereas I was a Brisbane girl, although at that time when I auditioned for it, I think I was in Sydney living in a camper van, which I did when I first went to Melbourne to do Prisoner.
Such is the actor's life sometimes.
Yes, very peripatetic. And I had been living in my camper van called JT Smiler in Sydney. And I gave a farewell party to all the people who'd supplied me with bathrooms and toilets. And I knew where every public facility was in Sydney before I left. And when I first got to Melbourne, before I found a house to live in, I lived in the car park of the Channel 010 network station in my camper van, and I used to go in to work in the morning from the car park.
Suffering for your art, Carol Burns.
No, I loved it. It was the way I got around then. When I first went to work in South Australia, I had a contract down there when the Adelaide Festival Theatre was just being built. And I was going from Brisbane then, so my mother packed me off in my other car at that stage, which was just an ordinary sedan with a fruit cake and all my belongings in the back seat. And the wonderful thing in those days of travelling was that truck drivers looked after you. Because I was a woman travelling alone in my car down to Adelaide, I used to see the same truckies on the road, and I'd pull over into their areas to have my piece of fruit cake on the way. And they would keep an eye on me, and as some truck went past, when I was pulled up, you'd hear, bah, bah, you know, and wave, and they'd make sure that I got safely on my way.
Fantastic. Prisoner brought you a Logie. What else did it do for your career?
Bugger all, I think. I chose to leave it. Now, perhaps if I had stayed with it for a long time, it would have made me famous, and it would have led to more jobs, perhaps, in that field. But I have always been fairly independent-minded about what I do and how long I do it for. And I thought that there was a danger of... I respect the work that I do tremendously, which is why I've been able to have a passion about it for so long. And I thought if I stayed with it, they would have done too much to that character. Mind you, enough happened to her anyway. I don't know how many times she escaped from jail. I don't know how many times she had punch-ups and riots and mad fits and all those sorts of things. But I decided to leave, and I asked to be shot, because I've heard that in soap operas they will bring characters back after a while, and I wanted to avoid the temptation of succumbing to the lure of money. That's something that I've learned over 45 years, is that the money doesn't count. As if you've got enough to pay your bills, that's all you can rely upon. And sometimes you can't even rely upon that. There's very few of us are in that sort of Nicole Kidman, Jack Thompson frame where, you know, you can buy the property in northern New South Wales. But I wanted to leave, and I decided that I would say, shoot me. So I had a wonderful death scene with my soul ascending to heaven and my prison girlfriend crying over my body and the word bastards on my lips as for the policeman who shot me.
Frankie Doyle left a wonderful legacy in television. How did you find the character within yourself, such a charming, elegant woman, to find such a rough-as-guts prisoner?
Well, this is the great gift of my profession. I am asked always to keep my eyes and ears open. You can never be bored as an actor because you're always observing people. If you're sitting waiting for a tram, I love public transport. Public transport is the best reservoir for characters. And I found elements of Frankie Doyle when I was coming back down from visiting my brother in Port Douglas, he's a marine biologist, and I was coming down on the train, and I was sitting opposite two little boys who were... what little brothers are to each other. You know, they didn't really want to be sharing the seat. They didn't really want to be on the train. So they wriggled and they squirmed and they pushed and they were saying, piss off to each other, piss off, with the older boy. And so I thought, now that's the sort of mentality that this character is, that Frankie Doyle is. So I found the attitude from a nine-year-old boy, and I found the laugh from just hearing somebody in the street, because there was she had a shockingly raucous laugh. So I just found that from somewhere else. And you just, when they offered me the part, they said, do you want to play the most hated woman on television? And I said, just so long as you let me show why she's hated. Of course, as soon as you do that, everybody falls in love with her. So I had proposals of marriage and offers of support from people all over Australia, which was wonderful. And it was used... It's really interesting how you don't approach any role that you do thinking of its social relevance. You approach it, you do in one way, but I don't think art has to be done for a social purpose. I think art is worth doing in its own right. But with that character, I actually found out that people used it as a talking point for problems with their families, and I didn't have a problem family. I had a wonderful family. We're very supportive, lots of talking around the kitchen table and all that sort of thing, which I think generations have lost now. I don't know. So I've now seen lots of changes in Australian society, and I've lived all over Australia, so I've seen lots of various ways of living, and I've lived sort of extremes myself, from as I told you, living in a camper van when you're unemployed to then having a nice place to live in, as I do at the moment, because my husband and I, Alan Lawrence and I, have been together now for coming up 33 years, and we're both creative artists, but we've managed to put a roof over our heads, which we're very proud of, the two of us.
That legacy we talk about of Frankie Doyle, that great gift she gave to the lesbian community in many ways, it really extended to America as well.
Absolutely. When I went, part of the romantic story of Alan and I meeting was I'd finished doing Frankie Doyle in Melbourne, and I'd gone back to the Melbourne Theatre Company and doing an Australian play called Marsupials with Max Gillies. And our company gave the visiting Hamlet Company from the Old Vic, with which my husband was working at the time, a party. And I went to that party because I'd met these three blokes from the company the week before with Deborah Kennedy, and she was saying, what do I do with these visiting artists? And I said, well, I know Amanda Muggleton's got a bump-out party, so we'll take them along to that. And I just dumped them at the party because I'm not really a party girl. And my husband apparently had eyes upon me and hoped to chat me up that night, but missed the opportunity. So the night that we actually gave the party, he was one of the people I talked to, and because I thought I'd been terribly rude the week before not talking to them. I had to talk to him. He was the last person I talked to before I was heading out the door. Now, 2 hours later, I was still there talking to him. And then I offered him and his stage manager a lift back to their hotel. And then he invited me up for a cup of coffee. And the rest is history, as it were. And that's the day we celebrate. We don't celebrate our marriage because that was all because of the two governments. Alan wasn't going to be allowed to live in Australia. I wasn't going to be allowed to live in England. So we got married. But we don't even remember what that day was. We remember the day that our eyes met across a crowded room.
It's a wonderful love story. It's one of Australian art scene's most beautiful love stories. What does this incredible man mean to you?
Oh, good heavens. Well, it meant that I went and lived in England for a number of years, for one thing. He's a creative artist. I'm an interpretive artist. So we don't have that conflict of that I think a lot of acting couples might have, of the competitiveness. So I understand the obsession that he has about his work, and he understands that about me. And I suppose we have our separate rooms in our flat, and we sometimes just meet in the kitchen for cups of tea because I'm busy preparing for a role, he's busy writing music, and there's always something going on in his head. And I think that's the thing that's maybe kept us together, is that he fascinates me. There's always something to talk about, and I think talking is the best thing that you can do to keep relationships alive. Although, there's other elements as well, which, keep a relationship alive and happy.
Such as, Carol?
We won't go into that on national radio.
Through your courtship with Alan, the ghost of Frankie Doyle was following you around the world. I mean, during her death when it was screened in America, there was an amazing scenes in Los Angeles and San Francisco. How did it connect with those audiences?
The interesting thing is they felt, a lot of people said, were we undermining their standing? Was it working into a cliche? But I didn't get that response from the lesbian and gay community. They have embraced the character and thought that it was liberating to sort of have this woman as a heroine on television. And I was there for the wake when they walked down the street with a coffin with Frankie Doyle and ended up at a disco. And it was my first experience of a mosh pit. And so it's the great gift that an actor has throughout life is that they meet so many people that they wouldn't meet otherwise. So I often say that I'm not always paid, but I'm never unemployed, because all my life is aimed towards reinvigorating myself for the next character. I just want to be able to keep working and keep getting better. You never really achieve what you want to achieve. And what better way to die but at the end of a life of going, oh, hang on, I just still want to do, there I go. You know, so that's how I hope to depart this world.
What a wonderful sentiment. You're listening to Conversations. My name's Trent Dalton. My guest is actress Carol Burns. Carol, can we go right back? When did you get the acting bug?
I seem to have come into this profession by chance. When I was a little girl, I went with a friend of mine from Milton State School to a Saturday morning activity group, and I wanted to do art because my friend Nettie Bleyerveld was doing art. But I went along and I hadn't signed up and there wasn't any more space in the art group. So they said, well, across the hall, Miss Jones is giving, has a drama group. So I joined Miss Jones and her drama group, and my first job at the end of that term of Saturday workshops was to play a little old lady who believed in fairies at the bottom of her garden.
A stretch in the early days.
And I achieved that by throwing up in the wings. I was so nervous beforehand. And it was just a solo piece, you know, with a rocking chair in the middle of the stage. And I did it, and to thunderous applause from my mother and my father and whoever other friends of the family they could bring along to join the group. And I thought, this is really communicating. You know, you can talk one-to-one with people, but to be able to talk from a stage to people and in somebody else's voice, I don't. One of the things that makes me shy away from a lot of things, or what I'm very nervous of in the responsible positions I have, is that I represent them truly, because I don't do things unless I believe them in them. If I believe in them, I want to serve them well, and I never feel capable enough of serving them well. So if I use a playwright's words, well, they're these clever people who can write dialogue that lives forever. You know, you've got Shakespeare, Edward Albee and Barry Oakley, you know, all writers I've worked with and love. And they say it for you. And they give you that conduit through which you can communicate with so many people at once. So there you are. There's the writer behind you, this singular, clever, clever person, that you are the conduit for those thoughts. And so you get made to think about those things throughout your life too. So many of us settle down and stop thinking. And what I want to do, A.C. Grayling, I think, the commentator who other people call a philosopher, and he apparently doesn't call himself a philosopher, he says, lead a conscious life. Well, I think that's what I'm striving to do, to know things, to lead a conscious life. And that's what's led me to becoming a vegetarian, and that's what's led me to do service within the community, as I do within my community of artists, with mentoring other generations of actors coming through, and with assisting people who are no longer able to work.
Absolutely.
Through the Benevolent Fund.
It also led you... Tell me about the Benevolent Fund.
The Actors Benevolent Fund is a... it's a charity which has branches all around the world, but in Australia, each state has its own branch of the Benevolent Fund. And we assist other people within the profession, not just actors, variety artists, people, technicians, you know, anybody who brings the arts to you as a community. We don't help with unemployment situations because, my God, we all face unemployment at the end of every contract. You know, you have a contract for 8 weeks with a theatre piece, you have a contract for 4 days with a film, or for 8 weeks with a film, and then it's over. So we can't help with unemployment. But what we do help with is sudden illness or age or accident. When somebody is hurt on stage, for instance, of course they're covered by workers' compensation, but it's really nice to know that somebody who works in your profession cares. So there's usually somebody who'll go visit in hospital. There's always flowers. Sometimes just a grocery voucher when you hear that somebody's a little bit hard up and doing it tough. It just arrives through the mail. But we rely upon a network, and that's one of the things that I think as I keep going back to this idea of the community of artists, we need to keep talking to each other, because the only way we hear about people in need is through this network. And our charity is forever helping other charities. For instance, there's a big variety show that gets put on once a year in Brisbane, which is to help positive women suffering from AIDS, the AIDS virus, and just people living positively in general too. So we help those charities. We're forever going and helping, you know, doing announcements or being entertainers at other charity events as well. So it's a way of the whole helping network going out, because I think it's part of this consciousness that you're conscious of how your society needs connection.
You mentioned accidents, stage accidents. What sort of accidents can befall a stage actor?
Oh, my goodness. I've fallen off a stage. luckily, I didn't hurt myself, except for bruises. At the Melbourne Theatre Company, there was this... it was marsupials. It was just before I met Alan. The set was a black ramp that went out to the performance area, and that ramp was masked on either side by black felting, but there was nothing underneath the felt. It was just to make it feel like a void. So one day coming out from backstage, I didn't judge my turn well enough, and I went down through the felt rather than along the ramp. But we live to tell these tales.
You didn't break a leg, per se.
No. Break a leg is the good luck saying for the theatre. And that is supposed to protect you from things like breaking a leg. Although I was in a show in South Australia with the South Australian Theatre Company, which is now the State Theatre Company of South Australia. And we were doing a show called The Incredible Mind-Blowing Trial of Jack Smith. And the entrance at the beginning of the show by Patrick Frost was to make a leap through a circus hoop, a paper-covered circus hoop, do a tumble down a ramp and land on his knees at the front of the stage saying, ta-da, this is the incredible. And he went through the hoop, rolled down, landed on his knees, ta-da, I'm sorry, ladies and gentlemen, I've just broken my leg, we can't continue. And that was the end of that season.
The actor's life is a fragile one.
Yes.
Carol, when did you first make your first journey to England?
Well, I started off for England. I didn't get as far as England, but I started off for England when I was 19 with the blessings of my parents, who have been wonderfully supportive all my life.
How so?
Just because they always said, well, do what you want to do. If you fail, we'll be there for you. If you succeed, we'll take pleasure in your successes. But we were a very open family, allowed to do what we wanted. I wasn't given any religion that I had to follow. So I am now a declared atheist, but I went to Church of England, Catholic Masses, Salvation Army, the local Buddhist temple. You know, I went and tried them all out and thought, this is all a load of nonsense to me. So I shall believe in humanity. And I think that's, again, one of the things that through my gift of a career in the arts enables me to like people.
You mentioned you didn't quite make it to England.
No, I didn't quite make it to England. I got as far as Malaysia. And then Malaysia. I ran out of money. So it was obvious that I wasn't prepared for going to England. I, instead of doing the backpacking, staying at the YWCAs and that sort of thing, I actually stayed in proper hotels. Well, of course you're going to run out of money. You just can't do that. And I got as far. But I had life experiences, because that's when it was in the time of the Vietnam, you know, back in Vietnam. And there was rest and recreation going on for American servicemen in Kuala Lumpur. And I was staying in the same hotel, and a local serviceman asked me whether I'd like to see his emeralds, and then I found out what his emeralds were. I thought, Mommy!
What were his emeralds, Carol Bird?
You keep asking the most embarrassing questions, Trent.
Was it a tough time for you that you came back to Australia? Where did you go from there?
Oh, goodness. I've lived and worked all over Australia. From the Queensland Theatre Company, I went to South Australia, and then I came back and I was a guest lecturer at the Darling Downs Institute of Advanced Education, which is now University of Southern Queensland. And at the same time, I was doing a show in Brisbane. So I was commuting Toowoomba, Brisbane, doing Nurse Ratched in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which was a show that I got an award for.
One of the great roles in any theatre or film.
Yeah. Then I went down to Sydney, and then I went down to Melbourne. But my first foray out of Brisbane was to South Australia, and I was in a wonderfully fortunate position there too. We were going to open the Adelaide Festival Theatre, and it was late being finished, so you had a company of contracted actors. This just doesn't happen. This is a dream situation where we were being paid to just learn, to have classes. There was the management of the State Theatre Company at the time was what we called the Holy Trinity, which was George Ogilvy, Helmut Bacchytis, and Rodney Fisher. Now, George Ogilvy is a legend in theatre and television in Australia. He is the most wonderful director. I worked with him again in Melbourne when we were doing Deuce of Fish, Stass and Vi, and that was Pat Bishop, Nancy Hayes, Vivian Garrett and myself. And you learn something from everyone. Pat Bishop taught me drinking and swearing. Nancy Hayes taught me tap dancing, and Vivian Garrett taught me how to meditate.
But which was the
George
most important
Ogilvy.
Lesson.
Yes, which one has stayed with me through my life. I try to keep in touch with all of them. But back with George Ogilvie, we had this 6 months where we did clowning workshops, improvisation workshops. We became a really moulded company. And if we had the luxury of time, if the economy could afford to give artists time, they would get such work out of them. Because you learn a shorthand with each other and you learn a deeper understanding of each other and you can fulfill roles so much more quickly. Because a lot of our work is done outside of the rehearsal period now. You know, when you hear you're going to get a role, you fight hard to get a job. And then, of course, you're terrified that you're going to be able to do it properly or not. So you then start preparing as much as you can, working on the text, looking at, you know, word by word you look at the text to see that you truly understand what you're getting at. Because a writer, when you think about it, they actually put down a comma for a reason. They use an ellipsis for a reason. So what you try and nut out is why they've done that. That's why I like writers' work rather than the improvised stuff. There's a lot of, I suppose I'm an establishment artist, really. There's a lot of people are very good at doing the ad hoc, you know, creative improvisational stuff. But I like working with texts, I suppose. I just love words.
You're listening to Conversations on ABC Local Radio and the World Wide Web.
Welcome back to Conversations. I'm Trent Dalton, sitting in for Richard Feidler. My guest today is actress Carol Burns. Carol, in 1986, you received what was probably the worst phone call of your life.
I was working at the Nimrod Theatre in Sydney at the time, and my husband was back in England. We have lived it between the two countries. We started off thinking, oh, we'll live 6 months in Australia and 6 months in England. We'll have a perpetual summer. It ended up being 10 years here, 10 years there, that sort of thing. But in this particular period, he'd gone back to set up a studio in London, and we were heading back there. And I got a phone call just when I'd finished a contract with the Nimrod saying, can you come as quickly as you can? Because I've just been diagnosed with an aneurysm on my internal carotid artery, and they said I need to be operated on immediately. And there's a 70% chance that I'll be paralyzed if I survive the operation. If I survive the operation were the things that rang in my head. And, of course, I got on a plane as soon as I can. Luckily, I had finished a contract,
Carol,
and I didn't have to walk out on a show. But
that flight is about a 25-hour flight. to think about your dear husband.
Well, that's where Vivian Garrett's meditation comes in, I suppose. it was harder for him, I think. You know, all I can do is get there and be supportive, but Alan is going through this thing. They actually reduced his blood pressure to almost nothing and told him to lie down for while they tried to plot a way into his brain. And at first, it was going to be this 70-30 situation. Then it was 50-50. And the professor, who doesn't usually concern himself with something as trivial as aneurysms, said, oh, look, this man's too young, and he's a composer, and he needs to be able to use his hands as well as his brain. Let me have a look at it. So they actually kept him in suspension for 10 days and I got there, of course, and could go and sit with him. But we had to be very careful not to make him laugh or anything. And, of course, when visitors were coming, they were wanting to be entertaining and wanting to sort of help him through this without becoming terrified by the whole prospect.
What exactly is suspension?
Oh, no, it's just reducing your blood pressure down to sort of so low that you can't do it. You just have to lie still. So it's enough to keep your blood going ka-thunk, ka-thunk, ka-thunk through your body, but nothing more. And so people were coming in and saying things like, you know, if you don't make it, Alan, can I have your guitar? which is a wonderful leavening thing to do. And the little lady who used to bring around the tea for all the visitors, the night before Alan finally went in for his operation, she said, he said to her, you know, I go in tomorrow morning. And she said, oh, good luck, Mr. Lawrence. You know, so many of them come out worse than when they went in.
Oh, very heartening.
Yes. But these are the sorts of things that you have to have that sort of attitude to it, or it's going to be too much. And I think the great thing for us was that Alan and I talked again, as I say, we always talk. And I was able to... It's one of those things where you get to a position like that in life and you think, okay, what does this person mean to me? What would I do? And I was able to say with absolute assurance, whatever happened, that I would be there for him, because I knew that was the most important thing. You know, apart from my acting, Alan is the most important thing in my life. He comes first. And he was very pleased with himself because he said when he was given this situation, after I'd gone that night, he said, now, this is the sort of thing where you could have a deathbed conversion. Now, do I believe in God or don't I? No, I still am an atheist. So.
He stuck to his guns. What did happen, Carol?
Well, the high, high praise for the extraordinary team of surgeons and nurses that cared for him at Maida Vale Nervous Diseases Hospital in London. He came through with flying colours. He said he's never had a headache like the headache that he had when he came out of it. But the first thing he did, he woke to Korngold Symphony was playing in the intensive care room where he was. So he thought, right, my brain's working. I recognise that music. And then he said, the next thing I did was wriggle both hands. And I thought, ah, I can still play. And then I wriggled my toes and thought, ah, I can still walk. And within a very short time, we had nowhere to live. Within a very short time, they had transferred him from intensive care to a convalescent place where they actually set him up. They emptied out a box room and set him up so that he could start composing again. So at the same time as he was getting painkiller treatment, you know, a jab in the backside every 4 hours to sort of stop the pain, they were saying, yes, think, Mr. Lawrence, you know, write music, Mr. Lawrence, play, Mr. Lawrence. And this, I'm sure, was one of the reasons why he has come back, you know, 99%. He was told that he might lose the vision in his left eye, but he didn't even lose that. It was the most remarkable recovery. And those, if you're talking about God, those surgeons are God. They are so proud of what they do too, because he was able to be used as an influence on other people going in for surgery afterwards. Because in his time in the ward, after he'd come out of intensive care and before he went to the convalescent home, they were saying, "Would you mind going and visiting this person who's going to have their operation tomorrow to just give them, you know, show them that it can happen? You know, you can come through this." Mind you, he looked extraordinary because they take out a plate of bone to get into your brain and then they staple it back together. So he looked like a terrible sort of goth type bikey, so I don't know what, somebody that you wouldn't want to meet on the street on a dark night with these staples all through his head. But now he has the slightest of scars that you can see because his hair's thinning. But it's a wonderful story.
He had a deep inspiration after that operation. He's written the best pieces he's ever written after.
Well, he said that from then on, life is a bonus. He will not waste a day because every day he is a bonus to him. He could have been dead. So he's written, taken on writing some big pieces, as well as having a career in theatre, writing for and playing in theatre. He has written for film and television. But then we decided that he should have the opportunity to write for himself, the sort of music that doesn't sell well, contemporary art music, as some people describe it, you know, that plinky-plonky modern stuff. And that was one of the reasons we were considering. We closed the studio in London and coming back to Australia because we thought we couldn't live in London on one actress's wages. So we were sitting there pondering where in Australia we would come back to. And we started to get these faxes from my father saying, we're a bit worried about your mother. Her sight's starting to go. And within a week, these faxes were coming thick and fast. My mother's sight was collapsing. And she was registered blind within a very short time. It was macular degeneration, but it just went. It was an extraordinary situation. They kept on trying to, in those days, use the pinpoint laser to stop each of the blood vessels from bursting. But when they sealed one, the next one would go. And so poor Dad was very worried, as we all were. And since we had decided we were coming back to Australia anyway, we decided to come back to Queensland, which is my home state, and to Brisbane, my hometown. But we actually came back to Bribie Island because they'd shifted from the little worker's cottage where I grew up in Paddington in Brisbane up to their beachside home in Bribie. So we rented the house next door to them. And that's how I ended up living on Bribie Island for 10 years, was because being a support system for Mum and Dad. So we still had our freedom because Mum and Dad are one of those couples that say, no, you live your life. You know, we brought you up to have your life. We've had ours. Don't feel that you have to stay here with us. So, of course, living next door, that was good because we weren't right in each other's pockets. And Alan was able to write and I was able to travel for work. And being great believers in public transport as we are, we had to have a car because we had to drive from Bribie across to Caboolture to get the train down to Brisbane because I couldn't get a bus home after the theatre at night. So the last bus to Bribie Island was 6:30 in the evening. So that's why we eventually shifted and left Mum and Dad with other members of the family living close by and down to Brisbane.
How's your mum today, Carol?
She's going to be 92 this year and she's thriving. She now lives alone in their home. Dad died a couple of years ago, and she still goes square dancing twice a week. An inspiration to me. She would be one of the people that I would think, if I can live my life with that degree of energy and commitment, I'll be a happy woman. I've had wonderful mentors through my life. I think and I mentioned the four women who taught me the skills that I carry to this day, but also, when I started in amateur theatre with Joan Wally was the woman in charge, and she had an attitude to theatre of profound respect for everybody's job. And I think I had to make coffee for actors first. I had to sweep the stage. I had to learn to do the props. I had to be an assistant stage manager before I was allowed to step on stage. So I learned to respect everybody's participation in the making of theatre or of any event, like it carries over into television and film as well. And that has stood me in good stead. And Joan Wally, I think, is a mentor of mine to this day. Another person on a much more trivial level, Jack Thompson, because Jack comes from Brisbane too. There, Jack and Michael Caton and Judy McGrath and Rowena Wallace, we all came through amateur theatre together.
Theatre giants now.
And yeah. Jack taught me about progressive jazz. And so I love him for that. And also introduced me to yogurt. So, two things to thank him for.
There's another giant you've worked with, Geoffrey Rush. Tell me about your trip to Billawheeler.
Oh, Geoffrey Rush is a lovely boy. We used to all live together in the Pink Palace, which was opposite Albert Park, a sort of actors' flats in Brisbane, which was very nice. And Jeff was just a young man. I was a couple of years older than him. I gave him his 21st birthday party. And we worked together on tour through Queensland and a show called You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown, where he played Snoopy and I played Lucy. And Trevor Stewart, who's another great actor who went off to Germany to work and has come back to Australia occasionally, he was playing Charlie Brown. And when you're on tour, you get billeted with people and they give you parties and all that sort of thing. And there was a party going on. I think it was Billy Wheeler or Bar Calden, one of those. I get them mixed up. Because Billy Wheeler is where Bill Brown comes from, another giant of theatre.
Of course, and these are small towns. These are very, this is yes, the definition of country.
Yeah. In this small town, which shall be nameless, let's say, Trevor Stewart offered a cigarette of a certain sort. You know, this was back in the 60s, to, no, 70s, to the local policeman's daughter, of all things. Oh. You know, offered a joint to the policeman's daughter. She reported him. He got arrested, thrown in jail. I was the only one who had a Commonwealth Savings Bank account that you could get the money out of because there were no banks in town, so you had to go to the post office. So I had to bail him out the next morning before we went on to the next country town on the tour. Of course, the establishment were up in arms. There were pickets outside the theatres at the next towns saying, "Dope smoking Charlie Brown, down with Charlie Brown." Of course, we had packed houses. Now, poor Trevor Stewart had to get fired, of course, because he'd broken the law. But David Waters came out and replaced him, and we continued on our merry way with you know, wonderful houses. It was great. And I worked with Jeff again in a much more serious show, Juno and the Paycock, where he played Joxer, and who's the neighbour upstairs. And Joe McCollum was the director of that show at the time, and Joe was a very serious Irishman and thought that Juno and the Paycock was a very serious play and that we should be very serious artists when we took our bows at the end because we'd just been through a very dramatic experience. So when we were rehearsing in the Tech Week, finally rehearsing the curtain calls, Geoffrey Rush, in his wonderful loping way, comes down with a broad smile on his face, and Joe McCollum bellowed from the back of the theatre, "Geoffrey, stop smiling. Where's your effing dignity?"
You're listening to Conversations. My name's Trent Dalton. My guest is actress Carol Burns. Carol, what are your thoughts on fame?
I've never pursued it, but I think it's useful. A certain degree of fame can be useful because if you're known, then you get better jobs, and getting better jobs is the thing that I'm all about. So that's really how I would use fame. I have been famous in that other trivial way. I had done a film called Strikebound, which was Richard Lowenstein's first feature film, and it was about Agnes and Watty Doig, real-life characters in Wonthaggi in Australia. And this film was chosen to open the New York Film Festival. And I was in England at the time, so it was going to be cheaper for the producers to fly me from England to New York than it was to take someone from Australia. So I represented the film at the New York Film Festival. And I was rung up in England, and you know, I'm just an ordinary, you know, jobbing actor. So I hopped on the plane in ordinary clothes and arrived at the other end, no makeup, and you know, and I was met by there was somebody there with a big placard. You know, I thought I was going to get the bus to the hotel, but no, there was a limousine for me. With one of those stretch limousines with, you know, all the alcohol and everything in the back seat. And a minder. I had a minder for the time that I was there. And this minder was saying, "Now, here's your program, Miss Burns. We'll be going back to the hotel now. You get changed. Then we're going to the theatre. There'll be the first screening. You'll be interviewed after the screening. And tomorrow morning, you're in the banquette next door to Dustin Hoffman. He'll be being interviewed by such and such. You'll be being interviewed by somebody else." So you get... Your life is controlled, and it's not nice. So I went, saw the film, did all that. The next morning, here am I. I'm at my banquette. Dustin Hoffman's there, and I'm going, "Oh, look, that's Dustin Hoffman." and other people are going, "Oh, look, that's the lead in, you know, Strikebound." I did all the jobs that I had to do in support of this film. And then I went back to the head offices of the film festival after I'd done my duty, having been feted by them, looked after every moment, when I'd done my job, I went back in to say goodbye and thank you to everyone. And they said, oh, right, thanks. How are you getting back to the airport? By bus or by taxi? You know, there was no more limousine, no more.
Chewed up and spat out.
Yes, chewed up and spat out. That's absolutely it, which is why I have little regard for that sort of fame. And I know how difficult it is for people who live under that sort of pressure. I am luckily known enough to get work, but not so well known that it's a problem for me. Even when I did Prisoner all those years ago, which was, you know, I've always done lots of work that I value and that I hope people who see it value, but I haven't done a lot of high profile stuff that makes you famous in that way. But even back then, like Val Lehman and I would be in the same shopping centre and she would walk down one aisle doing her grocery shopping being mobbed and I would be walking down the next one not being recognised and therefore being able to do my shopping with equanimity.
What do you do between jobs, Carol?
Oh, panic about whether I'll ever get a job again. You know, I think actors have a terrible tendency to lack confidence. I work hard to try to, you know, get another job. I don't have an agent in Australia. I wonder whether I should. Maybe I'd get more film and television work there, but if I did. But I'm very happy with the work that I'm doing in theatre at the moment. But I never say no to a job. It's a bit like the elephant in the room. Whenever you're anywhere where there's somebody else who's engaged as a producer or as a director, they know that you're always on the lookout for a job. As a freelance actor, you are always scanning the horizon, seeing where the next work opportunity is going to come from.
That must be emotionally taxing. There's a sense of...
Well, I suppose when you've been doing it for this long, you get used to it. And I think there's an awful lot of the population now is actually having to go through what actors have gone through and been expected to go through for a long time.
You're always working, though. You're a student of life. You always find yourself consulting people on public transport because that is an essential part of any actor, learning from your fellow human being.
Yeah. And it's also in terms of, I think we have to look after each other in terms of an industry as well, because everyone wants to be an actor. Everyone thinks they can be an actor. And no, you can't. It's hard. And why it's hard is that is why we have to be respected as a profession. And that's why I'm also president of the Union for Actors in Queensland, because I think that we do need to make sure that actors are valued. And it's very difficult economic circumstances, we understand, for producers, but we, as they look after their side of the bargain, we look after ours. And if you work to performer certified agreements, then everybody's safe because the producers know what you're going to ask for, you know that you're going to be looked after, and that's why I value unionism. And I think unionism is community, again. I just can't get away from it. It's what, and I suppose I reluctantly serve. As I was saying to you earlier, Trent, I find that I respect these things that I do so much that I want to do them well, and I never think I'm doing them well enough. So I'm always striving to do better, and that is really an advantageous way of living life because you're never self-satisfied and you never relax. And so it keeps passion alive.
Is there a national body for what you're doing in Queensland?
Oh, yes. Yes. It is a federal union. And I'm on Federal Council and the National Performers Committee, which is a peak body of actors. So it's actors looking after actors again. We deal with lots of problems that come up. And
What problems, Carol?
For instance, making sure that that actors in Australia are seen, are given job opportunities first before producers look elsewhere, particularly with those films and television that are being supported by the Australian government with tax rebates and or if anyone gets subsidies, that they should be looking to employ from the pool of available actors before they look overseas. And this is the way you create the work opportunities for people to then go overseas. So we have actually launched the careers of so many wonderful actors who serve the world now with their performances.
You paint such a brutal picture of the craft. Why would anyone want to be an actor?
Because they think it's easy and glamorous. It worries me that so many people are being encouraged into it through high schools and secondary schools and universities. There's ways of taking money from actors. There's not very many ways of giving money to actors. So if you want to do it, be prepared to do it. Do it because you have to, not because you think it'll be fun.
Carol, we're running out of time. I really want to ask you about what I consider possibly the most romantic gesture any man has ever done for his wife, and that was Alan composing a three-part symphony dedicated to you.
Well, it doesn't get much better, does it? That it's been performed, which is very nice because a lot of contemporary music doesn't get it any more than one performance, but it's been performed a couple of times. So, yes, if I'm remembered for nothing else, I'm going to be remembered for as being the person that Divisions for Orchestra by Alan Lawrence was dedicated to.
How did he present it to you? Did he hand you the sheet music? Does he?
Yes, that's it. It was sort of like, here it is finished, printed out, and you might like to have a look at the first page.
How do you possibly repay such a romantic gesture?
Well, I suppose it's impossible. It's a lifetime of effort. I think that's why our relationship is so successful, is because we actually work at it. Of course it has ups and downs. It's not a fairy tale. That would be really silly. It's real. And I think that's what we need to do, is keep things real. And when I'm in theatre, I'm looking at the characters that I'm looking to play, I'm looking for why they are who they are. And I think if we all looked at each other and took an interest and said, OK, why are you as you are? You know, why have you chosen to live in this small town? Why have you chosen to grow that crop? You know, when I was coming back from a person who's become a friend of ours now, is a CSIRO scientist, and I met him on a plane coming back from England and said, hello, what do you do? And he said, I work for the CSIRO. And I said, oh, what do you do? And he said, well, I'm in wheat. And so we talked about Durham wheat for the next 12 hours. And that's the great gift of my career, my profession.
Carol Burns, thank you so much for being my guest today on Conversations.
Thank you, Trent.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.